Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode of In the Barn. I'm Robin.
And I'm Kelsey. In today's episode, we're going to talk about part two of the Santa Anita racetrack tragedies that occurred in 2019. We're going to discuss the lead up and the ownership change that led to these deaths. Before we get into the story, before I hand the reins to Robin and let her part of the story, I want to give two quick little like public service announcements. The first is, did you listen to part one? Because like that was my part, and I'm going to be really upset if you didn't listen to my part. If you just came to part two because you were like, I want to hear about the horsey deaths. There's horsey deaths in part one. There's interesting stuff in part one. So please.
I mean, there's human deaths in part one. There's a guy that gets chopped by a fan.
We don't know that he died. He died. He's dead now, for sure. I don't know if it was the fan's fault. You should go find out. You should go listen to that episode and go find out if it was the fan's fault. You should go find out what happened the 1st February the track was ever open. What happened then? Was a horse too slow? Was he deadly slow? I don't know. You're going to have to go and listen to that episode to find out. The other thing, unrelated to Santa Anita, is I know a lot of you are in a part of the country right now that is probably a little hot, a little warm. Whenever there's like a heat wave or just summer in general, I see a lot of people on Facebook and Instagram and different horse resources asking about the heat index. When is it safe to ride my horse? When should I exercise my horse? How should I keep them cool? And a lot of times asking about the heat index specifically. So public service announcement. The heat index does not apply to horses. You actually have to use what's called the wet bulb globe temperature index, which is really cool. It takes in a lot more considerations, a lot more factors. If you used the heat index to tell you when was a good time to ride your horse, it would tell you noon.
Which we all know that's not true.
As humans, we all know that's not true. It did take scientists until post-1992 to discover that also is true for horses. But if you want more on heat and what to do in heat, how to keep your horses cool and comfortable, check out our episode 40. I think it's called like Too Hot to Trot, or What Is It Too Hot to Trot?
I think it's When Is It Too Hot to Trot? But we go into a lot of the common misinformation that is spread about and kind of help debunk that and give the research behind what is actually effective for your horse.
Absolutely. So this is a lot of this research was developed by the FEI in lead up to the 1996 Atlanta Games, which were hot and humid in the summer. So go and check out that podcast. You're going to learn everything you need to know about taking care of your horse in the heat, when to ride, what to do when they're hot, what methods to use, and why we don't use the heat index, because the heat index it doesn't apply. It does not apply to horses. It only takes two factors, humidity and temperature, into consideration, and there's actually way more than that. So yeah, that's my public service announcement. Otherwise, I think I've got everything. I think it's time to hand it over to Robin.
Right. I think it's time to dial back the clock, not as far back as Kelsey dialed it, but bring us back to where she left us off, which is around 1998 to the 2000s. And the 2000s is where we unfortunately see a change in leadership with the Santa Anita track. And with that change in leadership, you see a spike in horses dying and more devious activity happening at and around the track as a whole than you kind of saw happening before. And I will say, kind of as my own little disclaimer before going into the whole bloody history that is Santa Anita, I will be discussing the massive number of horse deaths that have occurred over the years. However, I won't be going into each and every one of their individual cases because there's just too many. And there's so many horses that have been killed at this track over this last year alone. In 2022, there has been so many horses already killed at this track, let alone the last 20 years. So some horses I will talk about, like Medina Spirit, because their deaths caused quite a big stir and gained a lot of public traction. Mm-hmm. But what we're focusing on with this episode is the bigger picture. And that bigger picture is who runs the place, because they are the ones ultimately responsible for how these tracks are run that is contributing and causing so many deaths to horses.
And I don't think deaths weren't happening prior to 2000. Check out part one. We go into it. It was a different business model. And I think that led to a lot of what we're seeing today is a different business model.
Right. And it doesn't mean I'm not by any means trying to diminish any of these horses' deaths, because they each deserved a way better fate than what they were handed.
Absolutely.
But like Kelsey said in the last episode, and where we left off was roughly around 1998 when we saw the Stronach Group come onto the scene where they bought the Santa Anita track for $126 million, which is a hefty amount today and was a pretty hefty amount back then. They are still the current owners as of today and have played a major role in not only how the track is run, but who they allow to race there and their constant desire to push for more and more money. So, who is the Stronach Group? They are based out of Aurora, Ontario, and are a family-run business originally started up by Frank Stronach, who founded Magna International, which is an international automotive parts company. And from there, he also started Granite Real Estate and the Stronach Group. On a separate note, he also founded a political party in Austria called Team Stronach for Austria.
What? Why in Austria? What did he need in Austria?
They're Austrian.
Oh, I was going to say, like, what does he need in Austria? What does this random Canadian dude have against Austria's political system? Like, I feel like Austria is one of the few countries you don't hear a lot about. Like, they're just totally fine by themselves.
I don't know. He's doing things. I think he wanted at one point to be a politician. And he founded his own political party called Team Stronach for Austria. I didn't look into like any of their political platforms or anything, but I did think that his political team name was pretty hilarious.
I love that it's a team. I love that it's a team as a political party. That is somehow weird, but also great.
When we saw the Stronach group come onto the scene of horse racing is when they purchased Magna Entertainment Corporation's holdings from the Magna International, which is its parent company. So they have like a bunch of different companies going around, which is kind of how you can track down all their different holdings because they own like all these different companies in addition to the Stronach Group. Currently today, they own 5 thoroughbred racetracks, those being Santa Anita, Golden Gate Fields, which is kind of a funny one because if you look it up on Google, for some reason, the first time it tells you that the Stronach Group bought Golden Gates Field is July 2011, but that's not true. They actually acquired it in December 1999 for $77 million. They also own Gulfstream Park, which is based out of Florida, and they acquired that one in 1999 for $95 million. And then they own Laurel and Pimlico Racecourse, both of which were purchased in like a joint deal in 2007.
Okay.
And while you probably heard a few names of racetracks you might recognize, and we're only talking about Santa Anita during this episode, I think it is very much so worth mentioning that Gulfstream has had an unreasonable number of deaths and is just as bad, if not worse, than Santa Anita. And I think it'd be really curious to check out how like all these tracks stack against one another, like against one another, and who the common trainers are that are appearing at these tracks, because by and large, it seems the tracks owned by the Stronach Group are awful. They have terrible track records and like some of the highest numbers of horse deaths.
So interestingly, I am pretty sure, 99% sure, Joseph Smoot, who designed Santa Anita racetrack originally, also designed Gulfstream.
Oh, interesting. See the levels it goes into.
Yeah, there's a lot of connections between those two tracks, which I find unsettling. Because, yeah, I think Gulfstream is technically worse than Santa Anita. Like, they have more deaths. But, yo, it's Florida. You know, you miss a horse or two every day.
Yeah, it's crazy. The Stronach Group owns a Greyhound racing track, which are well known for being so kind to their dogs.
Okay, is it just me? Or is dog racing somehow way worse than horse racing? Like, dog racing gives me, and this may just be because I watched The Simpsons and that's my only experience with dog racing. It was like one Simpson episode. But like, there is something really sketchy about it to me. And did you know dog racing was illegal for a much longer period of time than horse racing? Because, well, specifically in California, because that's where we were researching, because the racehorse board was very anti-dog racing because they thought it would like take all their money from them, that like people would go and bet on dogs instead of horses.
Oh, weird.
Gross to me about dog racing. And if you're a dog racing fan, I'm so sorry. It's probably that one episode of The Simpsons. It's probably why I think it's disgusting. Or maybe I'm just right in The Simpsons, or right? Because didn't they like, doesn't The Simpsons know everything?
Greyhound racing is not well known for being, how do we say it, for the animal? It's not well known for caring much about the animal's health. Just like horse racing is not known much for caring about the horse's health.
I say we go back to calling them plants, by the way.
Racing plants. Such a disturbing terminology they used to describe it back in the day. A horse racing plant, which is literally how they treat it, is like putting these young horses on conveyor belts just to turn them out as quickly as they can.
And if they break, there's another one.
But in addition to the tracks that the Stronach Group owns, they also own ExpressBet TV and ExpressBet. Now, ExpressBet TV is where all these races are streamed. I think it used to be known as like Horse Racing TV, and then But now it's ExpressBet TV. And then ExpressBet is a wagering business that allows customers to wager on over 100 different racetracks through their phone alone. They also own Amto International, which is a service providing technological advancements in the pari-mutuel wagering industry. They run simulcasting venues at their tracks as well as off-track betting. So clearly, based off their assets, they are very much so invested in the gambling side of things, not really the horse side of things. Like, they own so much.
Yeah.
They own, like, the main streaming basis of horse racing. They own the main gambling platforms. So that is where they place so much of their focus on. And then randomly, they also own Strufex. Strifex, which is a company that manufactures bedding from pelletized straw, which they actually used to manufacture. I think they might still manufacture out in Lumberton, North Carolina, which is very close to where I used to live. And they had a big fire at the plant back in 2015, where I could only find one news article about it, where it burned down the entire building. And apparently, while the sprinkler system went off, the alarms didn't, which the firefighters thought was odd because the sprinklers and the alarm systems were connected to one another.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I couldn't find out anything more about it. You know, at the time when that article came out, it was like July 2015. The building had been burning for several days because it burned a whole ton of like straw bales and straw bedding. And so it burnt very hot, and then it ended up burning for quite a few days. And so they weren't able to get in there yet to determine what the cause of the fire was.
Yeah, that's go back and listen to part one, because there was a mysterious fire in part one as well.
Oh, there was.
I found a 1936 article today that was called it a mysterious fire. So I was on to something.
But I think it's pretty clear at this point to say that the Stronach Group, they are just one big happy family, you know. Casually, Mr. Frank Stronach was suing his daughter Belinda for, you know, just a measly $400 million.
Why?
The lawsuits, I believe, started taking place or getting notice in 2018. They were fighting over who got control of the Stronach Group itself. Frank Stronach thought his daughter was like icing him out of the business. He thought she was like taking away his decisions as the businessman for it. And based off of how the multitude of lawsuits where they were settled in 2020 finally came about, where Belinda got control of the Stronach Group's thoroughbred racing and gaming businesses, as well as the real estate attached to those businesses. And part of the deal was that Frank would relinquish any claim to current assets that make up the Stronach Group, while Frank and his wife, Elfred, took over the operation of the family's racing and breeding operations called Adina Spring Farms. So Belinda got the whole Stronach Group. That is all hers.
Interesting. Isn't she also like a politician or something?
So she did. I can't remember. I didn't write down what her political parties were, but now I'm thinking about it, I probably should have, since, you know, he was into politics and now she was into politics.
According to Wikipedia, it says her political party was liberal, but then it also says other affiliations conservative. So are those just the two options?
I don't know. I remember reading that and I was like, wait, which one is she then?
Yeah, because that's she's one of the two, but maybe both.
But Belinda is currently the chairwoman, president, and CEO of Stronach Group, and she has been very vocal for years about making a massive push to maximize profits, resulting in near constant racing schedule that takes place at their respective tracks. Small little note, the Stronach Group is kind of known for being totally cool and basically welcoming to trainers who have been cited for using performance-enhancing drugs with their animals.
Oh, sure. I mean, better results, right? It's like baseball. The only time baseball was good was when everyone was using drugs, right?
Yeah, it takes a lot for them to ban any one trainer, and it seems like they do it really grudgingly whenever a trainer gets banned from their tracks.
Interesting.
That is who the Stronach Group is. We're going to take off now in 2004, which is kind of picks up where they decided to expand the gambling they had going on at their different tracks. In 2004, they took it upon themselves to place about 650 Class 2 gambling machines which are slot machines at their racetrack in Oklahoma they owned at the time, Remington Park. And then throughout the next couple of years, the Shonut Group also began adding additional gaming at various tracks of theirs to include 516 slot machines and poker tables between Gulfstream Park and Hallandale Beach in Florida.
I mean, there's a lot of downtime when you're at the track.
I guess so, but like, sheesh, is that a lot of gambling they have going on?
But isn't there like only 8 races a day? So what are you going to do the rest of the day?
I don't know. I guess you got to gamble. I guess that's how they keep their income going.
And it keeps people there too.
But also in 2004, there was a study that was initiated that was looking at comparing the fatality rates in California across different track surfaces. And those track surfaces were synthetic, turf, and dirt. And Santa Anita was one track in particular that came up in this study. See, in 2006, the California Horse Racing Board mandated synthetic surfaces at California racetracks who were conducting more than 30 continuous days of racing in any calendar year. Tracks who fell into this category had to either change their surfaces by, I think it was 2008, or they had to close their doors. 5 racetracks within California fell under these new mandates. You had Bay Meadows, who was run at the time by the Shonut Group, although their agreement ended in 2004, and instead of changing over their footing, they decided to close their doors instead.
Interesting.
Del Mar fell into this group. Golden Gate Fields also fell into needing to change their footing over, which we know is owned by the Shonut Group, Hollywood Park, and Santa Anita. Santa Anita was actually the last track to change their footing over, and they waited all the way until September 2007, and we knew that they had to change it by 2008 to be in accordance with the new mandate by the California Horse Racing Board.
So they waited a very long time.
They waited a long time. It was the last thing that they wanted to do. Prior, though, to switching over their footing, those tracks combined had an average fatality rate of 3.09 per 1,000 starts, so just over 3 horses would die per 1,000 starts they had going on at the racetracks. After the installation of the synthetic surfaces, the combined fatality rate dropped to about 1.95 per 1,000 starts, so roughly 2 horses per 1,000 starts would die. Not as much or as big of a drop as probably people really want to see, but that's a whole 1 horse less dying per 1,000 starts, which it came out to be about a 37% reduction in fatality rates with the change in surfaces.
Which seems worth it.
Right, seems worth it. That's, I mean, if we're not killing our horses, that's pretty cool. Like, I'm all for that. That's pretty cool. At the end of the study, though, they discussed that despite these lower fatality rates, many are still heavily opposed to turf or synthetic surfaces. A big reason they said was that synthetic surfaces have proven themselves to be rather difficult to maintain.
Yeah.
They take a lot of man hours, which costs the track money. Synthetic surfaces lead to more track closures throughout the year due to unsafe footing because of potential weather. And one of the stats they mentioned was that within the first 75 years of racing on dirt, Santa Anita only had to close their doors for 4 days due to inclement weather. However, since switching over to the synthetic surfaces, Santa Anita had to close their doors for 14 days due to extreme weather. When it came about, though, to Santa Anita installing that synthetic footing originally, was that they found themselves in a bit of a pickle with designing and installing their synthetic surface because they did it wrong.
Sure.
They had improper materials.
Sure.
They had construction issues that caused them to close for... Can you guess how long they had to close for? They were pretty upset about it.
One day.
No, a week.
Think about how big a track is. So, like, synthetic material, it's the faux grass, like turf grass. A lot of people do it in their yards. I'm imagining it's something to that effect, but, like, is it dirt? Or no, is it like an arena footing?
No, it's like an arena footing, so it has that rubber coating.
Oh, okay, okay.
Originally, when they were, I will give this to racetracks, I understand, but when synthetic footing was originally, like, pushed and advertised, it was, you know, low maintenance footing. It was very easy to maintain, but what they didn't account for was the extreme heat and sun in California and the number of starts happening on that racetrack that, like, they were wearing through that footing a lot, and so it had to be replenished a lot more.
Interesting. I mean, I know that's the study didn't look into this, but I'd be curious because we're now realizing all these years later that that synthetic footing, it does not mimic dirt, and therefore it's causing it a whole different set of problems, like it, with interrupting horses' natural movement and stuff. It'd be curious to if they found that the horses were having other injuries, maybe not fatality or life-threatening injuries, but, like, were they getting injured in other ways?
Actually, they were. There was complaints from jockeys about synthetic surfaces not letting them slide.
Yep, exactly.
To the same degree that dirt surfaces had. And trainers also argued that synthetic surfaces had caused more soft tissue injuries. I don't know if those have been statistically confirmed yet or not. that if it does cause more soft tissue.
I mean, that is, so I think part of the Footing white papers, which I still need to read through, that is what they're starting to discover, is that it does not slide and
it stops that movement.
Exactly. And there's natural step, not sliding. We don't mean like raining, not sliding. When they set their hoof down, there's a natural slide to setting the hoof down that interrupts their gait that changes it.
Exactly, yeah. But in all these explanations that they were giving about the track that, you know, talked about why synthetic surfaces might not necessarily be everyone's cup of tea or why they weren't in big favor of it, I had a hard time believing that San Anita really cared about the lack of sliding it offered horses or that it was causing more soft tissue injuries. Like, the trainers were concerned about that, sure, but those running the track didn't care. What they cared about was the fact that it costed them a lot more money to refurbish it. It costs them a lot more money to maintain it, and it makes gambling harder. Horses don't run the exact same on synthetic surfaces as they do on dirt. The US's handicapping service is based on speed ratings,
yeah,
which are considered less useful on synthetic surfaces. This upsets wagering, and this upsets bettors because they have a harder time figuring out how to win.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
No one that is putting this footing into tracks cares about the impact that it's having on horses.
Well,
they care about how it's impacting the gambling.
I mean, it is interesting, like, when you think, you know, you have to, like, I was kind of thinking of, like, the backroom conversations that had to happen at this time, because, you know, California is making so much money off of these tracks, yet they're now passing laws that are could be interfering with the amount of money they are going to be making.
Eventually, I think they overturned that mandate.
Sure.
Because as soon as they could, San Anita got rid of that footing.
Sure.
But we're not there yet. We are still in 2008 now, where the Jockey Club Equine Injury Database hasn't kicked off yet. So the Jockey Club didn't really start keeping track of fatality rates or stats of that until roughly 2009. But after reading through the 2019 report done by the Racing Board, I was able to find that in 2008, roughly 24 horses died. But that is definitely not counting those that die behind closed doors at the track, which you'll find out many of these fatality stats only look at exercise-related deaths. They don't look at the horses that supposedly colicked or died of mysterious other reasons or were just put down and you never hear about their names again. It doesn't take into account those horses, and I did find a few stats later that actually do in later years, and it's almost double. Whatever death number they reported for that year, you have to almost double it for how many horses actually passed away at that track.
Interesting.
But 2008 also marks one of the many years Santa Anita hosted the Breeders' Cup. From 2008 to 2014, Santa Anita, along with Churchill Downs, alternated with each other in hosting the Breeders' Cup. And I did notice a correlation to when the Breeders' Cup would come around to Santa Anita. They had a lot higher of a death toll. So I'd be curious if that carries over to other tracks.
I actually think Churchill is more deadly than people realize.
Oh, I am sure.
And I don't know if that's Breeder Cup related, but I did find their name when I was doing some research that they were coming up as not the image you would think.
In 2009, the fatality rate was looking a lot better. At this time in 2009, Santa Anita still had that synthetic footing. And the fatality rate was at 0.9 deaths per 1,000 starts. So by 2009, the death rate had dropped by almost like a whole nother horse. And this was the first year that the Jockey Club has records of fatalities at the track. And I find it really funny that the Jockey Club and the California Horse Racing Board can't seem to agree on how many horses died. And the Jockey Club says that it was 5 that died in 2009, as opposed to 19.
Oh, well, that is a slight difference. Yeah, they must be using different metrics.
No, I think they were just, the Jockey Club is only looking at those who die in a race.
Okay.
They're not looking at anyone that dies in a workout.
Gotcha. Okay. That's fair, but also annoying.
Yeah, it's a little bit annoying, but when you actually start looking at the Jockey Club stats and you look at Gulfstream, it is disturbing because they have like up in the 20s of horses dying in a race alone.
Yikes. Yikes, yikes.
And then I was comparing because I was like, okay, well then what does Golden Fields or Golden Gate Fields have? And they also have a really high death rate. And then I was looking at, you know, other tracks that weren't owned by the Stronach group, and they actually had a little bit lower consistently than their racetracks.
Interesting. So there seems to be something in common.
The thing in common is who owns them.
Sure.
The study we discussed earlier a little bit ago that kicked off in 2004 that saw tracks changing their surfaces around 2007, that ended and concluded in 2010. And so as soon as they could, Santa Anita got rid of their synthetic surface in favor of replacing it with their traditional sand and dirt mixed surfaces, despite the lower death rates they were seeing with the synthetic. They were seeing lower death rates, but they changed over almost immediately because they don't care. They cared about, you know, they were losing money on that. It costed more to maintain. They didn't want to put the effort into maintaining.
Right. And I bet that footing, the synthetic stuff, has to be replaced frequently. Just thinking of like...
It does.
An indoor arena, it's going to stay a lot longer than it would in an outdoor track.
Right. And refurbishing that synthetic material on the track also changes the track itself a little bit, which takes trainers a little bit longer to accustom their horses and get like new running times down. Once we head out of 2010 in 2011... There was about 27 deaths that year. However, going in 2012, we saw a massive uptake in deaths to where they had 35 horses die. And once again this year, they were hosting the Breeders' Cup. They were also the go-to place for a filming of a TV show called Luck that they filmed in 2011 and 2012. And this was an HBO series that was kind of based off of, it was like all around racehorsing and like the rough and tumble racehorse world. It was like a drama that they had filmed. It was a 10-episode series. It was filmed for one season and one season only and was terminated before the second season was finished filming in 2012. They had racing scenes that were filmed at the Santa Anita track because one of the producers, David Milch, thought, and I quote, "It's the most beautiful setting for horse racing that I've ever seen."
I think Del Mar is way cooler, being like right on the water like that. Can you see the water from Del Mar? I'm sure you could see it from the grandstands, but like Del Mar is right on the beach. Like that's kind of cool. Or like almost on the beach.
I don't know. Looking at Santa Anita, it is not a very pretty track. At least to me, it's not my cup of tea.
Is it prettier than the Hoover Dam?
I don't know. During the filming on the first season of Luck, two horses had to be euthanized after fracturing bones in their legs because they were running old, injured, arthritic horses. It was what I found in one forum is that like they weren't physically fit horses they were using for this TV show.
Sure.
One of the horses was euthanized during the pilot episode. So like the TV show was off to a great start. While the second horse was euthanized during the filming of the 7th episode. And for a 10-episode series, that's not great. Like what would we have gotten up to if we had hit 15 episodes in the series?
Yeah, good thing there wasn't a season 2, I guess. Or they didn't go further than that.
Oh, but they were immediately renewed for a second season.
Oh, was the show good?
It got pretty good ratings, but the HBO was like, we took the proper precautions. They only ran the horses 3 times per day and gave them a break in between runs. But I just want to throw in there, if you took the proper precautions, typically healthy horses don't shatter their legs if they're running 3 times a day. That's not normal. If you took all the proper precautions, you shouldn't have killed 2 horses. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, they are on a racetrack. It happens. I mean, as we've learned.
You're filming a TV show.
They were going fast, Robin. They needed it to feel just like a real race.
But, you know, they were immediately renewed for a second season, and they started filming that second season, and it wasn't until a third horse was killed on set that they had an animal rights group demand they stop filming, and I agree with them for good reasons. The HBO tried arguing once again that, like, accidents happen, guys. We took the proper precautions. I don't know what more you want us to do.
Yeah, clearly it's not working.
Yeah, and I don't think they got very far into filming the second season either. No footage has ever been seen from it or anything. So heading out of 2012, after the Luck TV series was suspended from filming there, in 2013, they had about 27 deaths, which is... back to what we saw in 2011, the Breeders' Cup was not hosted that year. So that's about almost 10 horses less died that year than when the Breeders' Cup was held. And at the end of 2013, Santa Anita welcomed Dennis Moore onto their team, who began serving as a Santa Anita track consultant. And during his time working with Santa Anita, he was often criticized for being overly cautious when he would close the track in anticipation of weather that could and would cause damage to the track surfaces. And Dennis Moore was actually pretty well known for keeping track footing relatively safe. I mean, during his time there, you still saw a crazy number of horse deaths. So I think it's one of those things where, like, footing is definitely a contributing factor, but there is so much more going on that footing is not the only factor, if that makes sense.
I mean, yeah.
They, once again, in 2014, had 27 deaths. 2015 had about 23 deaths that year. And both those years, the Santa Anita track has a lot of starts.
Mm-hmm.
2014, they had about 7,000 starts. In 2015, they had about 7,500 starts. So they are running multiple races every single day, and they are having like large fields being run. And this is one of the draws to their track, is that they keep so many races running that tons of people can come and gamble, and they're bringing in so much more money because they have a constant just conveyor belt of horses cycling in and off that track running.
When you have that many races, does that mean you can open your doors to like so many more trainers, right? Like there's so many more opportunities there for anybody with a horse? Like is that part of, I wonder if that's part of the issue?
I don't know, because I saw that like smaller, I don't know. I mean, I definitely think when you're running that many, when you have that many starts per year, you have horses that are not recovering from their races.
Sure.
They're having to turn right back around and go out the next day. You have footing that is not able to recuperate from it. You have a lot of things going on that are factors that contribute to these life-ending injuries. But the ultimate cause of these like factors is the number of starts that management is pushing for.
Sure. And I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, but it is also, on the other hand, like it's so many hours in the saddle, you're going to have an accident.
That's their logic too. That's what they say at Gulfstream is you have so many horses running here. Obviously, we're going to have more deaths is because we have so many more running.
Yeah, I guess it depends what that percentage is compared to other tracks then.
I mean, this percentage is going up. Like 2016, it was like 2.5 deaths per 1,000 starts. They were almost back to that original number in 2004.
That I think that's the problem with Santa Anita and tracks like Gulfstream is they have so many deaths, but they're probably not they're having more deaths, but percentage-wise, deaths per 1,000, is it really that many more than any other track?
Right, and Santa Anita is a track that a lot of people have heard of because the public became aware of it in a few instances.
Yeah, absolutely.
Otherwise, people just don't know.
Absolutely. I think the general public has no idea. And think about it. If you have 3 horses dying for every 1,000 starts, how many of the public were there for all 1,000 starts, right? The amount of public that is rotating through, you probably have very few of the general public that actually is going to see one of those deaths, whether it's the one on the racetrack or exercise, because I know a lot of times exercise is open to the public too. You just have so few people that are actually ever going to see it to put two and two together to realize, wait a minute, there's actually a lot of horses not coming home.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Taking us into 2016, there was another uptick in fatalities where we had 35 horses die that year, where the Breeders' Cup was once again being hosted at Santa Anita.
What's going on? I don't get it. Like, what's the connection?
I wonder if, because you know where the Breeders' Cup is going to be run, I bet people are bringing more horses in to run on the track before the Breeders' Cup.
Okay. I mean, I don't understand.
That's what I think it is. But also in 2016... the Santa Anita track got a new announcer by the name of Michael Rona. And he, when he started off, began receiving death threats after he replaced the previous announcer, Trevor Denman. However, the police tracked down the guy who made the death threats and determined he probably wasn't wholly sane.
Probably.
And that he really wasn't something Rona needed to worry about. And Rona, turns out, wasn't the only announcer the guy had even threatened. The guy had been linked previously to threats against another announcer, Larry Colmus, who replaced Trevor Denman as the voice of the Breeders' Cup. The guy really was just fixated on Denman and apparently did not take kindly to anyone replacing him.
You have a favorite announcer. And that's true. I have favorite announcers at horse shows too. That's absolutely fair. Actually, you know what? I get it. I absolutely get it. Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Oh my God, you just did a whole 180.
I mean, do you know how like many times I was called like Kelsey Lotch riding Citrus? Yeah, no, I'd be pissed too. Like, someone can finally pronounce the horse's names correctly and then he gets replaced? No, I get it. Actually, that's fair. That's fair.
Okay, I just want to put this out here. Don't send death threats when people replace your favorite announcer.
No, death threats are wrong. Maybe just write them down and like keep them in your personal journal, but I...
Nope, don't do that.
Nope, not even that. That's wrong too. Okay, what can I do?
You can be disgruntled. And that's about it.
Okay. I'm disgruntled.
As you should. But at this time when Rona was getting death threats, the track, Santa Anita, actually, you know, rallied behind him kindly. They provided him with security for 2 weeks to help him, you know, go to and from his car to the announcer booth so that way he felt safe. What's interesting, though, is that Michael Rona, they kind of present as a somewhat new figure coming onto the scene, at least in a lot of articles I read about him. But he actually wasn't. Michael Rona, who replaced Denman at Santa Anita, came over from being the announcer at Golden Gate Fields, which, as we know, is one of the tracks that the Stronach Group also owns. So he's been a part of the Stronach Group and announcing for them for quite a few years before even making the move over to Santa Anita.
I'm still disgruntled. It's Locke!
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I still remember the One Horse Show when they pronounced every single name that you had wrong. They didn't pronounce it Kelsey. They called you Casey, like Lotch on Circus, I think it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. They got everything wrong. But now that makes you wonder if the guy in the car with the ninja stars, maybe he was just disgruntled at the announcers too. I don't know.
Okay. Well, moving on to 2017, away from the disgruntled people with the announcers and leaving clearly your traumatic announcer history in the past. 2017 saw a fatality rate that was about 2.27 deaths per 1,000 starts, which was roughly about 33 horses. So 2017 was also the first year where we saw the Stronach's power duo team show up at Santa Anita, which consisted of Tim Ritvo and PJ Campo. Tim Ritvo became the chief operation officer at Santa Anita, and at the time, he was quoted as saying, "We need to correct the guys who are here and not running and just using the place as a training track. We need to replace them." So it's no secret that the Stronach Group are heavily involved in the betting side of horses. Getting those horses out onto the track and into races is what makes them money. They brought in their power duo that came over from Gulfstream after making Gulfstream super successful to Santa Anita to make more money. It started at this time where they would pressure trainers excessively if they didn't enter horses into races, where they would threaten them with either evicting them, they wouldn't get stalls again, they would take away their stalls if their horses weren't running in a certain number of races, or if someone would pull a horse out of a race, they would get just verbally attacked for those decisions.
So you're encouraging people to become almost desperate. Like, if my business revolves around me being able to race my horses in California, Santa Anita is one of, like, the top biggest tracks in California. Encouraging people to make bad decisions. You're encouraging people to put themselves and their animals at risk with that being your management style. And it is almost this, like, desperation I can see that traders would feel trying to stay and keep their business. Horse racing's not super profitable. Like, it really isn't. It takes a long time to be successful in horse racing and to work your way up the trainer ladder till you're getting quality horses to run. You don't start running quality horses your first time. That just shows how little they understand the business from the trainer and horse side of it.
Well, they don't care.
Well, sure.
Yeah, that's all true. Is like they're creating a desperate environment, but that's kind of what they want. That's what makes them profitable, is that people are clamoring to put their horses in no matter the risk. They don't care if the horse dies on the track. They can just replace it. They have another stall. If that trainer can't fill the stall, they'll give it to somebody else.
But then it's interesting when you layer that on top with, like, how prevalent drugs have become in horse racing. It makes a lot of sense if Santa Anita is probably not the only racetrack with a similar model to pressure trainers to get their horses on the track and racing. You could see why people would be, you know, desperate enough to turn to that, those sort of things. I'm sure there's plenty of people that aren't desperate that also turn to drugs. I think we covered that with Jorge Navarro and his whole organization. If that kind of pressure exists, absolutely they're going to turn to drugs to get their lame, injured horses to run.
In 2018, the horse deaths were at about 26 that year, and someone did die at the racetrack in June of 2018, but there's practically no information I could find other than that perhaps it was a potential suicide. I tried looking back into old archives, old data, and I couldn't find anything more than like a very short, like single paragraph article about someone dying at the racetrack and that they didn't have more information at that time.
I skipped over it in part one, but there were actually multiple suicides at that track over the years.
Ugh. Yeah, no, the track has also had murders happen at it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good place to hang out.
Super good place to chill. In December of 2018, which is a very crucial month because when Santa Anita originally came on to the public's, like, really came on to the public knowing about them was December 2018 to 2019, like that beginning of the year. And so it's important that Dennis Moore was hired on back in 2013 at the end of that year. And then at the end of 2018, Dennis Moore stepped back from the Santa Anita because he felt they were encroaching on the standards he set for the track and was worried about potential budget cuts affecting how he was allowed to run his job, how he was allowed to maintain that footing, and when he was allowed to close the track due to inclement weather. He was replaced by Andy LaRocco, who is part of the track maintenance team for about 37 years, which is longer than the Stronach Group actually owned the track. And he was the assistant to Dennis Moore for the last 5 years before he left. Funnily enough, this wasn't the only change in the running of Santa Anita. It seemed briefly through 2018, the Stronach Group went through a period where they kind of cleaned house. They let go Michael Rona, who had been the announcer for several years. And you know what? If psych taught me anything, the announcer was in on it.
The announcer knew something, I'm sure. I'm sure he used his like Indian ancestry to create blow darts in his office.
But at this time, they also let go of Santa Anita's simulcast host, Megan Devin, along with ExpressBets TV's Aaron Vercruyasi and Richard Miglior. So they were letting go a lot of their announcers and a lot of their main hosts.
Why?
I don't know. So I was reading a lot of, the Blood Horse.
Oh, sure.
So I was reading a lot of their articles, and they had one that just kind of briefly mentioned that those people had been fired. And so I started noticing that like a lot of people from these different articles were getting fired around this time and were being let go. So it looked like for some reason, the Stronach Group was going through in 2018 at the end there and was just cleaning house.
Interesting, because they didn't go to a new model, so it wasn't like they restructured.
Nope.
They just replaced everybody. Well, they're probably too old to be announcers, because you know they're just outside of Hollywood, so there's an age limit for sure.
Maybe. I mean, it's interesting because Michael Rona had been announcing for them for years. Came over from Golden Gate Fields to Santa Anita. Like it wasn't that Santa Anita was the only place he had been announcing. So all those people were let go in December 2018, or around the end of 2018, we saw a sharp increase in the number of horses dying, so much so that the California Horse Racing Board initiated investigations into each horse's death. And so between December 30th and March 31st of 2019, there was 23 horses that died.
Yikes.
That's only, 3 months, nearly 8 horses dying per month. And you know, when the California Horse Racing Board looked into it, they found that they did not find evidence of criminal animal cruelty or unlawful conduct relating to equine fatalities at Santa Anita Park. However, if you go and read the LA County District Attorney's Office, their statement, they determined there was insufficient evidence to prove criminal animal cruelty or unlawful conduct under California law, which is different language than what the Horse Racing Board used, and I think is a much more accurate description of what happened.
Well, and that's, the thing we covered with the drugs is, the drugs is illegal because they're mislabeled. Like, it's not only, you could give a horse whatever you want. Like, that's not illegal. It's that there's certain pieces and procedures around it that are illegal, but the actual injecting them or whatever is not. So I'm sure there's lots of things that were going on that were questionable, but you don't have legal evidence of an illegal infraction.
Right, exactly. I do have a few morbid fun facts for you. Out of the 23 horses that died between those 3 months, 17 happened to die on their dirt racetrack, while 6 occurred on their grass turf. They noted 39% of the deaths occurred on surfaces that were being affected by weather. So that's a lot more deaths happening on the dirt track than were happening on their grass turf.
Sure, sure.
Fun fact number 2 was that 16 of the horses that died were under a trainer who had at least one other fatality within 12 months.
Okay. So multiple trainers, multiple fatalities.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Within a 12-month period, which that is crazy that you don't have an immediate suspension for a horse that dies underneath a trainer. I mean, look at eventing. If you have 2 falls on your horse, mandatory retirements, you have to drop back down a level. And if you have a third one or something, you can get yellow carded. Here, people are having 2 horses die on them. And it's it's a little bit of an issue, but not a major issue.
But how many trainers with more horses, right? Jorge had hundreds of horses underneath him that he was, quote, training, including horses at Santa Anita. I don't know if any of the horses he was, quote, training at Santa Anita were part of that group that died, or died. I'm sure they died. but that trainers,
sure, yeah,
when you are a trainer owner of horses or you have a smaller operation, your horses are much likely, more likely to survive than when you are a trainer and you are, say, sort of assisting with workout schedules, and you're really, the further removed that trainer is from the process and from the individual horses, the more likely those horses are to die. When you are a trainer slash owner and you're more personally invested in those horses, you have fewer horses, you know them by name, the horse is more likely to survive.
Which is disturbing. So I think it's really interesting that, you know, 16 of those horses that died out of the 23 were under a trainer that had at least one other fatality within 12 months. And those other fatalities could easily have been happening at other tracks.
Sure.
Right? That's not necessarily saying that that other fatality happened at Santa Anita. So you had, from 2018 December to 2019, 23 horses died. Then from March in 2019 to June, you had 7 more horses die of racing slash training related injuries, plus another additional 2 died from non-exercise related reasons. The numbers go back and forth from being reported at 26 to 37 horses dying total in 2019. I think it is the 37 number that's much more accurate, but it kind of comes out when you look at all the horses that were dying that weren't counted in that number. It was roughly something like 42 to 50 horses died at the track, half of which happening behind closed doors, where even the the California Horse Racing Board acknowledged that 4 other horses died between that initial period from December and into 2019. They died during that initial start of the year, but 3 of which were due to colic and 1 was due to laminitis. However, after reading through a lot of different studies, we know that pumping horses full of drugs can induce laminitis. It's pretty rare for young racehorses to be getting laminitis unless they're being, you know, pumped full of drugs.
Laminitis would be odd for a lot of reasons, because the typical cause of laminitis, right, is fat, unfit horses that are eating too much sugar, and racehorses do not fit that description.
There's 3 that died due to colic at the start of that year, and I cannot help but erase, like, I cannot erase that Netflix series, or it was like a Netflix episode that looked at the guy
No, I'm going to vomit. You go no further. You go no further.
Just plug your ears. Plug your ears.
I'm doing this not just for me, but for the people too. Oh my gosh. Okay, skip ahead like 15 seconds if you don't want to hear the most disgusting, disturbing thing in your life.
It was horrible. I almost started crying while watching this episode on Netflix, but a guy used to go around and he'd be hired to use jumper cables or electricity to electrocute horses, and they would attach one to their ear and one to their rectum, and it would look like colic. And that was how they do it, is so that they could get the insurance payout without anyone knowing that they had killed their horse intentionally. Okay, gruesome part over. Kelsey, are you ready to listen again?
Yeah. Oh, God. I bought the book thinking I was going to read the book and we were going to do an episode on it. But then after you told me that fact, we're not doing an episode on it. I'm sorry. Nope.
No, and the final horse they killed was...
No.
Not through electricity.
No. We're done. I can't do it.
Okay, sorry. We'll get back to the deaths at Santa Anita. Jeez, that's so much way better easier. These horses run until they break their legs.
Yeah, and then they're humanely euthanized.
Oh my gosh. So because when the Stronach group brought in their power duo of Tim Ritvo and PJ Campo, you saw a huge uptick in deaths leading to that like exponential number that happened in 2019. And it's all because of this formula they developed to maximize profits, which was more races for more bettors, including more claiming races for lower level horses, and aggressive lobbying of trainers to get their horses out of the barn and into the entry box. When the California Horse Racing Board went to dive in and do investigations on all those horses that died, they finally discovered that Tim Ritvo had been like aggressively lobbying to trainers to get their horses into races where, like I mentioned, you know, he was threatening to limit or eliminate trainers' stall spaces if they didn't enter horses frequently enough, which was just part of the track trying to keep their race schedule stacked to increase betting and profits. One trainer recalled pulling a horse from a race due to unsafe conditions and was verbally harassed in the barn aisle for this. And then other trainers, specifically those with small stables of 15 horses or less, reported that management had increased the pressure with a threat to remove or evict them from the barn altogether if they weren't getting enough horses into enough races, according to them. There was also trainers that would be verbally scolded and like yelled at in barn aisles if they would list their horse to only run on the synthetic surface track. So like if the race came up that that race was going to be scheduled for the dirt track, the horses would be automatically scratched. Those running San Anita were not happy with that. They wanted the horses to be available to run on any track no matter what. They didn't want trainers, you know, putting their foot down and saying, no, my horse isn't going to run on that footing.
Wow.
When questioned, because obviously when this was all taking off in 2019, the California Horse Racing Board reached out to Belinda as well as several news sources. And when questioned, Belinda simply said that trainers were, you know, merely asked about their racing decisions when appropriate. There may have been circumstances where horses may have trained or done a workout six times, and then that trainer will be asked, why are you working out as opposed to running? And Belinda presents this all as though it's very, like, civilized, very, you know, very nice. And we're just, you know, we're just asking why you're doing this instead of that. But despite her diplomatic answer, I very much so don't think it was handled anywhere near that civilly. I think people were pressured a lot to be putting an excessive number of horses into races that were not ready or could not recuperate in time.
Oh, for sure. I mean, this comes from the girl that like sued her father to get the family business. So no, I'm sure her diplomatic answer was
Actually, I think it was her father that sued her originally because she was cutting him out of the business. But and then she won the business.
No. And that my whole theory is I think he was onto something. I'm sure she was an upstanding citizen that had everyone's concerns in mind.
BJ Campo, who was the other part of the power duo and executive vice president of the racing division for the Stronach Group, came over from the New York Racing Association, where he also had a similar number of deaths happen, where he had like 21 horses die in 2012, which was quite a lot. And PJ Campo was dismissed by the Stronach Group shortly after the investigations were completed. There was also an instance where in February, between February 26th and 27th, had Mick Peterson from the University of Kentucky come out to evaluate the track that day. And he said it was safe. It was 100% safe, ready to go. And then 3 days later, March 2nd, a horse died by the name of Eskin for a Drink, broke its leg on the track. And he was like, you know, maybe it wasn't 100% good to go.
I mean, that's the hard thing is like the horses don't just break their leg because the footing was bad one day. You know, like it's leading up to it. There's a whole series of events that leads up to the catastrophic injury. Isn't going to show on any type of investigation. You know, like it's all these little things.
You also have a huge uptick in deaths, especially during the wetter seasons, because rain makes footing more dangerous. They don't care. They want to keep the track open as much as possible. And I could go on and on about the research report done by the racing board. It is so interesting. Like, you have to go read it. There was numerous times, not only the Stronach Group, but individuals of the group themselves were told to close the racetrack, even for just a few days, to let the footing recover, especially during the rains. And they would just repeatedly say, oh, we'll consider it. And then they wouldn't close, and a horse would die, like, the next day. Like, they were told probably 3 to 4 times at least within that couple-month period to close the racetrack for just a few days because the footing was getting so bad. And they constantly refused, citing that it would be too hard on the horses to remain locked up and that removing their morning training just wouldn't be ideal or fair to the horses.
Okay, so that is a half a fair point.
But you can't argue that if you're killing horses. Like, you can't argue for their health when the alternative is resulting in them dying.
No. All I was going to say is, like, the alternative is to have a very – I hate race training for the sole reason that those horses are locked in stalls for, like, 23 out of the 24 hours of the day, right? They only get out to do their exercise and go back. You can close the track but still allow hot walking, still allow walking on the track. There's plenty of other things. Like, they're being babies and going, well, then the horses have to stay in. It's like, well, no, there's, I'm sure, like 20 other alternatives that don't involve racing and don't involve leaving 61 barns full of horses locked in for several days.
Yeah. And also during this time, they were once again urged to switch back to the synthetic surface due to the clear correlation between, you know, poor footing that was happening with their dirt footing and the correlation of lower death rates. Like, they were having such a stark increase in fatalities that the California Horse Racing Board was telling them, like, you should switch your footing back, you know? Don't know if you noticed this, but the other footing was a little bit better in terms of keeping them alive. They also, if you go ahead and read the California Horse Racing Board report they did during this time, while they officially state that no drugs had played a part in these deaths, there was nothing illegal going on, it was also noted in the Racing Board's report that it's not always clear or officially documented which veterinarian euthanized which horses, which I guess with the mass production of horses, it becomes tedious to track that.
I actually am pretty sure if you were a veterinarian, and I'm not a veterinarian, so I could be wrong, but I was pretty certain every bottle of the drug, whatever drug you have, has to be accounted for and tracked and, like, noted. You need to know where every single bottle is at every single moment of the day, to the point of, I know I gave 2.5 bottles or one bottle or whatever the dosage is to this horse on this time at this day. Like, you actually are supposed to track the euthanized, I cannot think of the drug's name, it's too late in the day, but you are actually supposed to track that pretty closely, because that's not a drug you misplace.
The vets didn't even know which horses they had euthanized.
That doesn't make any sense. I believe that they don't know because they weren't tracking. That is, I'm 99% sure, completely wrong.
That is a massive red flag. And the fact that the California Racing Board saw that and goes, yeah, I mean, that's not, there's no wrong, like, illegal activity. Like, there's nothing wrong going on here. Just tells you how much the California Racing Board investigation really doesn't mean much, honestly, to me, after reading a lot of this stuff. Furthermore, there were errors that were noted on some of the necropsies, which is the autopsy they perform on the horses after they're deceased. There was errors on those submission forms that information was missing post an injury medication and its administration, which, yeah, because they were administering, like, a lot more that no one wanted to be knowing.
Oh, sure.
So, like, the California Racing Board was tracking that, like, these horses were missing information on their medication records and missing a bunch of stuff. And they were like, it's like, the trainers have a lot of horses. It's fine. This is what happens.
Yeah, nope, that's absolutely ridiculous. Because also, even if the trainer is giving illegal drugs, trust me, they're also tracking that. Like they're tracking everything.
Right.
And we know that the California Racing Board is not on, they've never been on, they've been in the operating in the gray since day one because of the massive amount of money they make off of these tracks. Like, it's, the state makes so much money. It's allowing the fox to regulate the hen house. Like, it's not gonna happen.
It's ludicrous to think that they would do anything differently. Another fun, morbid fact for you, because I actually went through, so the California Racing Board in their report, they include all their, you know, summaries and what, you know, when the horse went down, when they got injured, to when they were put down, what method they were, like, they used to put them down. And they, like, give some of them, they have more descriptions happening because the jockey gives more details about what happened to the horse. Mm-hmm. And so I went through and I read all these and, like, their wording is so disturbing. There was one where they talk about a horse being pulled up by the jockey and later euthanized for having a fractured sesamoid. However, the way they phrase this was that the jockey pulled the horse up, but the horse was still totally game to keep on running. But, you know, the jockey, being a good jockey, felt that it was necessary to pull up. And I just want to say, if a horse has a broken leg, they shouldn't still be game to run. Like, that, you're telling me there's drugs in the horse's system that you looked away from.
Well, I mean, they should be in pain, but there's probably also a huge amount of, like, anxiety and stress when you see, like, the herd running away from you and you think you should be part of the herd, that they're like, because that, I mean, that's the thing. Horses are prey animals. And so we have this huge issue with them, is that they try to hide their injuries because they don't want to be picked off as, like, the weakest member of the herd. So by the time you're noticing your horse is lame, that's often a sign that they're in a lot of pain, because they know that, like, any predator could see that they're weak and available for dinner. I could see why, yes, a horse would probably want to keep running despite the fact that they are three-legged, like, literally three-legged.
Yeah, it was just, it's just, I just hated that they, like, refer to the horse as still game to keep running while he had a fractured bone in his leg. Like, that's so disturbing. And then the sheer number of cases that the Racing Board evaluated here and then determine, and their conclusion was it was due to poor conformation or genetic disorder, was astounding to me. They had one horse they were talking about being clubfooted, and they're like, obviously it's because of his conformation he died. It has nothing to do with the trainers, the racetrack. I'm sorry, you shouldn't be running a clubfooted horse. Like, if it's that severely clubfooted to result in him breaking his leg, maybe we shouldn't run the horse. But like, they just dismiss it as conformation problems or a genetic disorder. Nothing illegal is going on here. There's like, there's no animal cruelty going on here.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, running a club-footed horse is probably cruel in and of itself. Not that club-footed horses cannot be athletic. It's just if it's to the point where it's damaging him, that does seem...
Right. Seems extreme. Well, 2019 was also the 10th time Santa Anita was hosting the Breeders' Cup. Have we noticed a similar trend whenever the Breeders' Cup rolls around?
Yes, but I still don't understand why. Like, I see that it's there. I just don't get it.
And then because of all the heat the Stronach group was receiving and Santa Anita was receiving, so they're like going through and they're saying, you know, look at these trainers who have been cited for previous drug use and you are still letting them race at one of your tracks or another, the Stronach group decided to take a stand. Like Kelsey mentioned in the beginning of the last episode where a training assistant was caught doping a horse by the name of TikTok, the Stronach group took a stand by showing they were concerned for the horse's welfare by banning that one trainer, and then they banned one other trainer that attempted to race a horse that, you know, already had a broken leg. But that's all they banned. Like, that's their big stand. They're like, look how much we care for the horses. We are banning the people that you publicly saw do something bad.
I mean, it's interesting because that is an exact repeat of the, like, 1988 drug scandal at Santa Anita that I shared. Like, that's exactly what they did as well. They were like, oh, well, you're gonna get in trouble. Like, okay, I'm not the only one, but okay.
While they were banning those two trainers, they banned whips. For jockeys, because why fix your footing when you can just take away the jockey's crops?
Well, okay, so the crop one is...
I get it,
because it doesn't make sense. Like, okay, so on a training principle, for just looking at this as science, you are punishing your horse when you whip them. I know you're encouraging them. I know, like, right, there's 100 different ways to use the words, but if the horse is already going and you're now using physical pain to encourage them to keep going, that's actually punishment, right? If we're looking at the different training principles, that's punishment. And I know there's a lot of pushback on using whips and using that from sort of the animal rights community, that we do need to reconsider the use of whips. Also, those jockey whips, I don't know if you've ever held one, are heavy.
Oh no, they're smacking those horses into another dimension with those whips. So like, I am all for the banning of those crops, but it felt like a very, let's tape a Band-Aid over the leak in the pool situation.
Yeah, but that's for the public. That the ban on crops is exactly for the public. Yeah.
That was for the public to get the public to come back and bet. They're like, well, obviously the horses want to run because they don't have a whip.
Sure. There was also a recent study that was released not that long ago looking at the forces applied with crops. And it's actually the whips that are lighter and more flexible and like snappier that usually have like the hand or the star or whatever. Those actually apply more force due to their ability to sort of flex through the air and smack the horse than the thicker, heavier racing crops. But they're still applying a lot of force.
So that kind of brings us to the end of 2019. But you have, like, seriously, you have, we'll link it obviously in our description, but you got to go read the Horse Racing Board report because it is so interesting and disturbing. Like, mentally prepare yourself for it, but it's so interesting that they are saying all this stuff and they're reporting all these things that they got from people's interviews. And they're like, yeah, there was no animal cruelty here and like no illegal activity. But based off the report, how did you conclude that? Like, these are your own words. How did you conclude this?
Yeah.
And before we skip along to 2020, just wanted people to be aware that Gulfstream, which is also owned by the Stronach Group, had 58 horse deaths within 2019. So that is a lot more that died in training and racing than Santa Anita.
Yeah.
And no one really heard about them.
I mean, I look at the political makeup of the two states, though. You wonder if that plays a factor. You know, just like the public perception of California versus Florida.
Yeah. But I think it's becoming clear that while the track Gulfstream itself has its own sort of history, the Stronach Group, who owns both Santa Anita and that track, are the real influences and the reoccurring theme in all these, like, poorly run tracks. In 2020, horse deaths dropped to about 16 to 20, I was getting conflicting numbers there, so I'm betting it was around 20, and then you probably also had a little bit higher of a number for horses that die behind closed doors. But I also like to say, let's remember what happened in 2020. Does anyone remember?
No.
COVID.
Oh, interesting.
COVID happened, and the deaths dropped from, what was it, like 42 the previous year to somewhere between 16 and 20 deaths.
Was it because the horses were sick? Were they quarantining?
I'm guessing it was because they weren't able to run as many races. I mean, oddly enough, Gulfstream still was racking up an insane number of deaths at their track, so I think they had a lot more training happening and going on there.
And it would have been the ban.
California, being a much stricter state,
yeah, exactly,
was probably getting affected a lot heavier than Florida and those at Gulfstream were.
Because I bet you there were people still betting in Gulfstream and there weren't people to bet in California due to the restrictions being much stronger in California.
At this time, they were contributing this lower death toll to like major reforms that were happening in California and commending them for reducing the deaths. That like there was a national law that went into effect in July that banned all medications, including things like Lasix within 48 hours of racing. Doesn't mean they're not still pumping these horses full of that crap for regular workouts and so forth, but they were saying that this band, that look how much it affected and reduced the use of drugs. Look how many less deaths we had. But you can't say that when like you had something like COVID going on at the same time. You know?
You don't count 2020. We know this. You throw that year out.
Right. And Gulfstream at this time saw 55 horse deaths in 2020. So like, and I know people are going to say, well, one state is California, one is Florida. You're going to have different regulations. Well, the mandatory reforms or the major reforms that went into place were national imposed anti-doping laws. Those were nationally imposed. That way they were getting states more on even footing and even ground. So yeah, you didn't have so much crazy activity happening from one track to another. They also in 2020 imposed anti-doping testing. However, they had a really hard time deciding which lab was going to do that anti-doping testing. And I don't know, like it took them a really long time to come to that decision, like months and months and months on end. So like none of that testing was being done because they couldn't figure out which lab was going to do it.
Weird.
And on another note, Tim Ritvo left the Stronach Group in March of 2020. And it seems that according to him and Belinda, he left on good terms to pursue other opportunities. He was a big part in the aggressive tactics seen in both Santa Anita and Gulfstream. He like helped create that formula of running the horses until they could no longer run. So I think it's interesting that he decided to leave the Stronach Group in 2020. So I couldn't find what he was doing now, but I'm betting he's off to, you know, some shifty things.
Oh, I'm sure. He's at another track. Monitor for what tracks death rate increases exponentially in the next year or two.
Most likely. So taking us away from our 16, 20 horse deaths in 2020, we saw 19 official horse deaths last year in 2021. And it became quite the talk of the town when, once again, a very public horse died at Santa Anita. Many of us probably heard of it. I know most people heard about when the whole Kentucky Derby results were thrown into absolute chaos. But it was Medina Spirit who ended up dying. He collapsed at the end of a workout, dying immediately of an apparent heart attack. As we were just mentioning, Medina Spirit won the Kentucky Derby in 2021, but he ended up failing a post-race drug test where his trainer, Bob Baffert, tried claiming that it was due to the dermatitis medicine the horse needed. But, sir, your dermatitis medicine seems to have caused your horse to have a heart attack.
Oh, for sure. For sure. You cannot tell me the horse did not have drugs in his system. Go back, listen to our Juice Man episode, how the drugs work, that a heart attack is absolutely like one of the most heart attacks and broken legs, two most common, those are horses dying on drugs. I know a broken leg does not seem like a horse that's dying on drugs. It's because they continue to run when they don't realize they're in pain. And they've like done a small injury and it turns into a big injury.
Right. And you have to go read, I know I've told you before, we got to go read the California Horse Racing Board's report done in 2019. All of the necropsies done on those horses are talking about how pretty much every single one of them has a history of previous injuries to that area. So like it's obviously not one time running them breaks their leg. It is a repeat history and repeat use of that, which is part of like this constant mentality you have to be running the horses and racing them at Santa Anita that causes them to break their legs. And the only way they're able to keep doing that and keep running and scoring well or like placing well is by keeping them toked up on drugs.
And we know, like, the Juice Man, it's not the only man, but he was consulting with trainers at Santa Anita, and I don't believe he ever went out to Santa Anita, but he was a trainer.
And it's really interesting because in 2021, Santa Anita became very, very popular for horses just to come train at, which is quite telling considering the track's history. And it's really interesting because that was when Tim Ritvo had left. Suddenly, people were coming again to train their horses at the track a lot more, and they were, you know, happy-go-lucky there. So I'm guessing there was a huge shift over to maybe not necessarily pushing so many horses to run, but definitely an increase in the drugs being used.
Interesting.
Which brings us into 2022, and so far this year, 8 horses have died due to racing / training injuries, right? That's still not counting the horses that have died behind the scenes. 2 of those horses died within 1 day of each other. It's actually quite tragic, as people talked about the 2 horses that die within 1 day of each other. There was 3 horses that died last month in May, all within the same week. Monday, May 9th, a filly named Speed Cuber was euthanized due to an injury sustained during a race. Then a few days later, May 13th, Pray For My Owner, another filly, suffered a sudden death immediately following a race. And this is something I hate that they say, that like they suffer a sudden death. And I'm like, well, no, it's not a sudden death. We know what it is. Their hearts couldn't take all the drugs being pumped into their system.
Well, they just overwork. Yeah.
Exactly. And then the following day, May 14th, Barraza, a 4-year-old colt, was euthanized due to a sesamoid fracture. And while people have talked that Santa Anita, Bob Baffer is banned from Santa Anita, he's technically not. Okay, he's technically banned for a 90-day suspension following Medina's positive drug test, but it's a statewide ban, not a Santa Anita-specific ban.
Sure.
And, like, a lot of people were shocked when they saw that a Hall of Fame trainer was being banned, but he's not even close to the first one from the Hall of Fame. Back in 2019, Santa Anita actually banned Jerry Hollendorfer, who is a Hall of Fame trainer, who was banned following the 4th death of his horses. The first death, Santa Anita was like, eh. Second death, they're like, well, maybe, but eh. Third death, they're like, buddy, come on, keep it a little bit more under the radar. And then the 4th time one of his horses died, they were like, well, what else are we gonna do? Oh no, please don't come back here. But he specifically, when he was banned from Santa Anita, plenty of people came to his aid and they're like, how could you? How dare you? He's running so many horses, of course some are gonna die. And he ended up moving his horses to Los Alamos or Alamitos race course.
Okay.
So overall, I'd say this year is shaping up to be just like all the others, with complete disregard for a horse's health and welfare. And I don't think any public outcry is going to change it anytime soon, which I think is the most disturbing and heart-wrenching part of it all. Because what we say, like the small things that you find that are contributing to these horses' deaths, it's the small-time stuff. It's those people that are owning the facilities that are leaving the history so bloody.
And that goes back to when the track started, the goal was to make racing the best thing, right? The goal of the track when it originally started was to be the queen, to be the jewel. This track was going to be sort of the best thing west of the Mississippi. And the goal was all about big prize money, best trainers, best horses. And over the years, it shifted to being profits, and it is now exclusively profit driven. And it's not about best horses being the most beautiful racetrack, being, you know, XYZ. It's about bringing in the most money for the investors. And anytime investors become the priority, everybody's going to suffer, whether it's, you know, horse racing or, you know, other businesses, other incomes. You're going to suffer if you're not the investor.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's heartbreaking, but that brings us to the end of our Santa Anita episode. I'll be curious to see how the track progresses now this next year. It'll be curious to see how Gulfstream continues on, and if any changes. I mean, I don't think we're going to see any changes, but
probably not at Gulfstream. But you wonder if they're going to, I'd imagine they'll probably lay low for a year or two, try to get some heat off of them before going back to their preferred business model.
Maybe, hopefully, but not if it costs them money.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I'm sure they're making enough money that they could take a hit for a year, but I imagine they'll go back to what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's interesting that 2019 was the first year that people really, you know, got all up in arms. I think it was because you had so many dying within just 3 months of each other.
Yeah, yeah. They had the whole year's worth die in a 3 month period.
No, and it's, I'm sure people are a little bummed that I didn't go into all the horses' deaths, but in case you can't tell, this episode is extremely long and we could not go into every single horse's death. Like, there's too many. And that's the sad truth of it.
And so many horses' names that, like, we won't know. And there's so, you know, we found this in the other episode, that there's horses that, like, well, that horse is definitely dead. I don't know where they are, what happened, but that horse is definitely dead now. And I think that those numbers are probably always going to be on the small side. They're always going to be missing horses because there are so many horses that just to track them all. Because think about how many horses probably go get injured and are lame, but not to the point of needing to be euthanized, but then go home and it's like, well, this horse isn't going to recover, euthanize it a week or two later. You know, like, how is that being tracked?
Right. The main ones that you're tracking and those numbers that you see are being reported are the ones that the public can easily track when they died. On that happy note, thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have any comments, questions, concerns, don't hesitate to reach out to us on Instagram at inthebarn.pod. Or you can send us an email, inthebarnpod@gmail.com. Remember to stay safe, stay classy, and stay in the saddle.
And just be better business owners. Also come up with better names for your political, like, organizations. Team's really what you're going to go with for your political groups?
Team Stronach for Austria.